Alan Gring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 3, delivered on August 30, 2016. The title of this lecture is The Federal Reserve.
Tonight, the Federal Reserve. This is the first of two special topics not covered in the book. The second topic is ethics and agency. That's on Thursday night. This one is on the Federal Reserve. Strangest thing about it is that when I go through these textbooks that are offered for finance students, I have a hard time finding one that brings up in any meaningful way the role of the Federal Reserve in finance. And that's a curiosity because the Federal Reserve essentially drives, controls interest rates, at least in the short run, and to some extent unintentionally in the long run as well. And yet you don't see this topic brought up in finance. Interest rates drive securities prices. You're going to see that very quickly tonight. Simple arithmetic exercise shows this fundamental relationship between interest rates and securities prices. But strangely enough, finance textbooks generally don't want to bring up the Fed. And they certainly don't want to bring it up in enough detail for you to see how the Fed manipulates interest rates. The best I can figure is that most of the writers of these finance textbooks are, generally speaking, free marketers, conservative, possibly even to one extent or another, right wing, and they don't like the idea of a government entity having that much power to influence and affect an economy and to affect the securities that we are the specialists in teaching about and using. Well, that having been said, I'm going to bring up a couple of terms for you. A different way of seeing things that everyone in their lives sees, talks about. But the way I'm going to talk about them is going to be a little different. It's going to kind of shape you to that part of this of your education where you're beginning to separate from the commoners, from the common people who don't have the specialized education. Look, I need to borrow for a couple of weeks $100. You lend it to me? Okay, I'll write you out an IOU. I owe you some money. Well, actually, you'll probably lend it to me at a little less than 100, and I'll pay you 100 back, and that differential will be your interest that you earn on, okay? Okay, in a case like that, I am issuing you a security. You are buying the security for the price that you give me. Let's say $98, 95, let's do it $95. I'm going to offer to sell you a bill. And that's what a short-term security is called, is a bill. And you are going to buy that bill at a price that reflects the loan amount. Now, the face value of it is what I pay you back. Another way of term that might be used, instead of issuer, sometimes you'll hear me say use the term writer. I'm the writer of the loan. Okay, here's a breakdown of it. This has to do with debt securities. If it's less than 1 year in duration, we call it a bill. I got a bill in the mail. The electric company sent me their bill. No. Actually, I wrote the bill. I issued the bill. All they're doing is sending me a memorandum of the bill and asking me to satisfy it. Remember, I'm the one who owes. I am the writer. I'm the issuer. From 1 year to 7 years, we refer to those as notes. That's a note. And if it's more than 7 years, we call it a bond. James Bond. No. It's a bond. Okay, so sir, you're going to achieve a dream that you've had for a very long time. You're going to buy a house trailer. 60-foot wide one. A 60-foot wide. It's a double wide. You've gained a little weight since college. So, and you've got all those Elvis velvet paintings to put on the walls. And so you've got to have some spaciousness. Not for you, but for the ladies. Okay, yes. Okay, so you're going to issue, and I'm a banker. You come to me, you say, I should like to borrow to buy my house trailer. And I'd say, well, certainly that's a noble thing. And so let's talk about a 20-year loan for it. Okay, so now, what kind of a debt instrument is that? It is a bond. You are the issuer of it. And you say, well, wait a minute. I went into the loan office. They had all the paperwork already there for me. All we did was provide you with the convenience of putting it all together so that we are sure that it meets our standards. But when we go to the actual signing of the agreement, the commitment of blood, I'm going to give it to you and you're going to sign it first because you are the issuer. And then you pass it back across the table and I sign it as the buyer. The purchase price will be the amount of the loan that you need. Let's say it's a $45,000 house trailer. So the price, I'm going to lend you $45,000. You issue me a bond, I sign, I accept, and I pay you for that bond. And the covenants of that agreement describe how you're going to pay me back. It's a little different from how it works. We don't think about the issuer, the writer, being the borrower in our normal language, but that's what we are. That's what we have to think of. And the lender is actually the buyer or the purchaser. So the borrower is the issuer or the writer of the security, and the lender is the purchaser or the buyer of the security. It's a little twist of language, but it tightens us up so that we can move forward and talk about these in a more technical, debt securities in a more technical fashion. Now, the next thing I need to bring up is consumer debt versus corporate and government debt. Madam, you decided that you needed a really nice car. So what did you do? You went out and bought a MEF. Okay. Don't they recall for ugly? I didn't know. You know, I thought the government did. But anyway, you wanted a MEF. Okay. So you do? Oh, dear God. Awkward? Okay. Moving along here. Okay. Now, how many years was the loan?
Two?
Okay, normally, okay, well, two, but normally it'd be like a 4, 5, 6 year loan, okay? But one way or the other, though, you're the issuer. What kind of a debt instrument did you issue? Yes, you issued a note. The bank bought your note for the purchase price, what you need. You might have put some money down on it too, but whatever it was you needed to borrow, that was the price that the bank agreed to pay for your note. And the note describes how you pay it back and all of that. The interesting thing is that consumer debt, every payment pays the interest that's still standing on the principal and also pays off part of the principal amount itself. We say that the payment schedule amortizes the loan. amortizes. Corporate and government debt doesn't work that way. In corporate and government debt, all that is paid during the life of the loan is the interest every year. And then at the end, one last annual payment on the payment is made, and the face value of the debt is satisfied at that time. It's a completely different way. It would be sort of like, I guess in consumer loans, once in a while, it kind of got popular at one time. There was something called a balloon loan, where you just paid the interest and then you paid the amount off at the end. But for the most part, consumer debt does not work like this. So for example, now let's do one. NFLX. NFLX, 4.5%, 2046. Sometimes you might just see it, 46. This would be a bond. This would be the statement on a bond. I know it's a bond because it's 30 years in duration. That's when the face has to be paid off. It will be, the interest is 4.5% of face. And this is Netflix, NFLX. You can go right to the to the papers and buy this bond. This would probably be an original issue. Now, there's one absolutely important thing for you to remember. I don't say it, but every bond has a face value of $1,000. A face value of $1,000. I don't ever have to say that. So if a company is borrowing, let's say, $100,000, what it is doing is it is issuing 100 of its bonds. Always $1,000, never any other amount. So in other words, NFLX, you buy one of these bonds. For the next 30 years, you will get $45 per year because the coupon is always stated as a percent of face. And then at the end, in 2046, you'll get one last $45 check in the mail and you'll get a check for your $1,000 back. In other words, in corporate and government debt, the issuer services the debt through the life of it, and then at the end pays it off. Usually, the bond covenant agreements have some requirement that the borrower be putting money away all the time to make sure that it has that face amount, but it's not part of what you get as the borrower. It's going into some kind of a sinking fund of some kind just to make sure that it has the money to pay off everyone at the end. But that's not part of what you get as the lender to me. Go.
So when that bond's paid off in 2046, does Netflix have to pay in $2046 or in 20?
You calculating dog you. See, that's an interesting thing, you see, because debt. Well, you see, that's just the thing. Debt favors, inflation favors borrowers. Because there's no indexing happening unless it is specifically an indexed bond. It is not indexed to inflation. So if inflation is raging, you see, I as the borrower am paying $1,000 to him in $2016. And if inflation has been snorting and roaring along, I have just screwed your position. You got it? That's a very good point. Now, interestingly enough, the government, especially, does issue inflation-indexed bonds. They generally tend to carry lower coupon because, as I'll show you in a couple of lectures from now, interest rates carry a lot of different baggage. One of the pieces of baggage they carry is an expectation of future inflation. So, theoretically, anyway, that 4.5%. wouldn't just be reflecting the risk of Netflix. It would also be reflecting the potential earning power erosion of that $1,000. I mean, that's speculative, though, because realistically, I mean, you know, when an inflation is predictable, you'll see interest rates go up, nudge up, and they'll have what we say they impound an expected inflation premium, and it's enough to cover the erosion. But if inflation goes up unexpectedly, that's when the borrowers make out and the lenders get killed, because that 4.5% isn't covering something like a hyperinflation that might happen. So in times of uncertainty, when the Fed is showing that it doesn't really know what direction it wants to go, or there's some major crisis and a lot of money has to be printed that's going to cause an inflation no one was expecting, well, that's when you'll see interest rates start getting really big, just because the uncertainty makes lenders push big premiums into their interest rates. But again, I'll talk about that later. But it's a very good point to bring up right now. Okay, anyway, there's the backdrop of interest rates. And now for your first fundamental principle of finance. When the government, and I'll use the government. Now, I said that all debt instruments in corporate and government pay only the coupon along the way. Actually, there's one kind that's a little bit different animal. It's a government T-bill, a one-year T-bill. The way it works is you buy it for a little less than $1,000. And then in 1 year, the government sends you a check for $1,000. That's how T-bills, they're what we call discount instruments. You buy it at a discount to its face value, but then you get the face value after a year. So you make money off the spread between the price that you pay and the FAL at the end. Now, when the government go ahead.
Is that, on that interest, that's not taxed? I mean, with the T-bill, that's not taxable, right?
Well, it is at the state level, I believe. Yes.
But not on the federal.
Don't believe so. And that gets into a whole world of things called munis, which are nothing that anyone in this room should be buying right now. Only the wealthy and very big trusts and things that have a very high marginal tax bracket should be buying municipals, because they are tax exempt, so their interest rates reflect the highest marginal tax bracket, and none of us in here are at that. Now, when the government borrows money, and I'm going to make this the way it used to be, now it's all electronic, but even today, when the government needs money, it holds an auction. Essentially, investors, lenders, bid on the different kinds of securities that the government needs. So the government might say it needs a variety. Usually there's a combination. Maybe $100 million in T-bills for short-term cash needs, some maybe $500 million in intermediates, treasury notes, and then some long-haul stuff, 20-year, maybe a couple of billion in 20-year bonds, treasury bonds. So there's always a kind of like a variety at these auctions. And it's all done electronically now in a blink of an eye. It happens so fast, I couldn't even show it to you happening. But back in the day, it was physically an auction. There were tables with these beautiful sheets of paper that represented the indenture agreement between the lender and the government and all that. So I'll take you on a journey where we have a specialized auction. It's just T-bills. These are one-year T-bills. The government needs to raise some short-term cash, so it's going to issue one-year T-bills. And it's got all of these T-bills laying out on the table. You can gather up a bunch of them and buy them, or you can gather up one. And so what we're going to do is we're going to have one of you go to the auction. This is your first auction. And madam, you're going to be going to the auction. I am the hostess of the auction. I'm Mabel. Well, how you doing there? This is your first auction, isn't it? Well, isn't that nice? Well, it's just good to see you here. You're probably looking at all those pretty pieces of paper on the table. Oh, one of those could be yours, okay? Yes, indeed. Such a bright investor you are. You're coming to the government's treasury auction. These will pay you $1,000 in 1 year, so they're very nice. And you look around and you notice that there's a lot of people here bidding. Buy. That's demand pressure. That'll push prices up when there's a lot of people buying something. Okay, so you've got to appreciate that when I say, how much would you like to pay for this one of those treasury bills? You don't have a whole lot of room to knock me, well, I'm going to get $1,000 a year, or I'm going to tell our 900. You can't, don't do that to me. I'm Mabel. I've been around the neighborhood. Okay? Give me a price for it. How much do you want to pay? Give me a bid. If it's a good bid, I'll let you have one. What is it? What do you want to bid for it? Remember, you get $1,000 in a year, so. Say
$975.
Oh, my. You're good. She's good. You're good. Okay? $975. Well, $975 it is. Earl! $975, 1 year treasury bill, drag it through the garden to go. Price, face, dollar interest earned, yield. So here we go. This investor paid a price of $975. To the issuer, the government. You, sir, what's the face value of that bond?
$1,000.
You're exactly right. Don't ever forget that. I will never tell you again, but it is $1,000. You might want to get that as a tat, you know? Face value equals $1,000. Yeah, no, seriously. You go to a finance singles bar, you go in there with some lame tattoo that, of Chinese characters, you don't know what they mean. They actually mean dog butt. But no one's going to. But if you go in there with a face value equals $1,000, you will go home with a friend. Face is $1,000. And I'm not, this is easier than it looks. Don't make it hard. Ma'am, how much interest in dollars does she earn in the course of the year? $25, exactly. That's all there is to it. So now we can calculate the yield on the bond. She got $25 for an investment of $975. Don't put $1,000 in there. I will try to trick you with a multiple choice answer that is $1,000, where the denominator is $1,000. Don't. It's what she invested. She invested $975 and she got $25. So the yield on this will come out to be 2.56%, rounded to two decimal places. Okay. So now, the next round. A year later, well, there you are again. Oh, my goodness, you came back. You got your $1,000. And, oh, my goodness, you are such an astute investor, so bright. And I've got a son. He sort of stays in the basement eating Cheetos. And you might be just what he, well, true, he's so ugly, knock a bulldog off a meat wagon, but there you go. Anyway, you look around, and I say, what do you want to pay for it? And then you look around and you don't see as many people there. Demand pressure has pulled down on her. on me. I'm able. And you see that there are not as many people buying these treasury bills. So are you going to still offer 975? Go ahead. Make Mabel's day.
I'd offer less, right?
Like, yes, sure.
Like 900?
Oh, no, don't do that. I mean, my goodness gracious. Well, I mean, you're going to break the government. It's already going to go bankrupt anyway, regardless of which one of those fools gets to be president. Okay?
950.
Good. 950. Earl, a 950 treasury bill. Put it in a bag. No mayo. I just went to the Mayo Clinic last week. They told me, they said, you got to. And I said, I don't want mayo. And, oh, well, anyway, the heck with you. Humor is lost on the young. What's the face? Bingo. 1,000. What is the dollar interest earned? She paid $950, she got $1,000, so how much money did she make?
$50.
$50. So now, for this round, the yield will be $50 in interest earned on an investment of $950, which comes out to be 5.26%, if you do that on your calculator. And there, my good people, it's an example of one of the most fundamental principles in all of finance. What happened as the price fell? What happened to the yield? Well, spank me, Buddha. Look at that. It's a fundamental principle. And it's not economics or finance. It's a mathematics principle. It is immutable. As price of a security goes down, its yield goes up, and vice versa. Price and yield are inversely related. So in other words, if the markets begin to think the Fed is going to raise interest rates, I guarantee you that the markets are going to start dropping securities prices. And this doesn't apply just to bonds. It applies to stocks, derivatives, the whole nine yards. Well, some derivatives countering. I shouldn't say that. But anyway, the bottom line is that when price goes down, a yield goes up, and vice versa. So if interest rates, so this is what I meant. Interest rates are probably the most fundamental driving force of finance. Now, other things move prices of stocks and bonds around. There's no question about that. But underneath all of those are interest rates. It's sort of like you, sir, decide that you want to have one of those really bouncy beds, okay, that has a real springy surface. So you're going boing, boing, boing on that. You also have a couple of ropes that you can grab and swing and then drop and boing, boing, okay? Now, those are the forces that affect your bedroom. But then we also have, you happen to also live on a fault line, the San Andreas Fault. Now, when that gives, that moves every bed, his extra firm, yours with the orthopedic surface on it for the sciatica. It does everyone's, okay? It's a substrate that doesn't look at the fundamentals of the ratios of a given stock or the risk level of a certain bond. It moves everything. And that's why when the mover of interest rates, the Federal Reserve, acts, it has to do it with scalpel-like precision. Because if it does things wrong, it's going to cause all kinds of excitement that we don't like. The former chairman of the Fed, Ben Bernanke, story is told that he was at a dinner. It was after he had retired a couple of years ago. And he was at a dinner. And he just made some off-the-cuff remark about the Fed's what it was going to do with interest rates. The markets within seconds, the market, it was making interest rates do all kinds of odd things. Securities prices just went whoom like that, because the interpretation of what he said was, well, the Fed's going to have to raise interest rates eventually. And of course, that was enough. Uh-oh, interest rates are going to go up. So the markets just said, okay, let's get the securities prices down now. So even a hint that the Fed is going to move is enough for the securities markets to reflect that in securities prices. Again, there are many other things that affect prices of bonds and stocks and derivatives and all that kind of stuff, but this is the one that's underneath them all. That's why it is so odd when finance textbooks don't talk about the Fed, which is the animal that moves the interest rates around. And now to the story of the Fed. And this video that I linked you to talks about this too. I'll go into some more detail on a couple of subjects on it. But look, after the Civil War, long time ago, you had the popular term these days is the banksters were in New York City along the East Coast. They were just having a heyday, doing all kinds of scams and schemes, pyramid schemes, Ponzi schemes, fraudulent, phony investments of all kinds, and banks that were about as dodgy as a bank could get. And there was a lot, they'd been going crazy before the Civil War too, and there was no president, including the great Abraham Lincoln, who had any interest in cracking down on all the nonsense and the consolidation of monetary control and shipping control in the northern states. This was one thing that just irritated the hell out of the southern states, was that all this control of the banking was favoring northern bankers and their rich crony friends. And it was leaving some pretty big gaps in development and shipping ability down in the southern states. But that's another story entirely. Well, it's not exactly. But anyway, the banks after the Civil War, they were just going crazy. And there were a lot of them that were bad banks. Look, when you are a banker, you take in money. You don't have to keep all of it because you got to lend it to make some money. But you have to keep a little of it, a fractional reserve. So that if you put, let's say, $1,000 into my bank, I got to keep some of it if you come back in and want some of your money. Or if you write a check to him and he comes back and I want to honor it on your account, I've got to keep some of it, a fraction of it. The rest of it I can lend out, okay? The problem was that these banks weren't a lot of these phony banks weren't keeping enough. And so when you came in to get some money from my bank and I said, hey, I don't have that much. It was a check he'd written. I don't have that much. You're going to panic. And then you're going to tell you have an account with my bank. And you're going to tell you have an account with. And then all of you are going to come in, and I don't have anywhere near enough. I just fold right there. Game over. You all lose. But the problem was even worse than that. Because the big dogs in New York City, in Boston, along the East Coast, in Philadelphia was going on too. Some rich guy, you gather up banks. You're a bank collector. You get banks for pennies on the dollar. You whisper to her and to her that my bank can't satisfy their accounts. Now, I can cover 20%. I'm prudent. I'm a good banker. I can actually cover it. But if you get enough people all at once to run my bank, I can't pay them all, and you have fulfilled your prophecy about my bank. And my bank folds, and you come in and you take it over for pennies on the dollar, and I'm out on the street. That was a game that was going on big time in New York City. these bank crises, one after the other, in the 1880s, the 1890s, 1870s. Even. And it wasn't just, it was obviously a microeconomic problem, but it was having macroeconomic implications because enough banks collapsing in one of these bank runs, that was causing all kinds of excitement on the other side of the country. For banks that depended upon that bank, my bank in New York City. So you see, the government, even though at the time it was really the best government money could buy, they grasped, this can't go on anymore. This has got to stop. So in 1913, the government Congress passed and the president signed the Federal Reserve Act. The Federal Reserve Act created a central bank for the United States. A central bank that was the bank of all banks. Interestingly, and I show this to my students in advanced finance, FIL 349, central banks or their precursors were showing up at least a couple of hundred years before we even got on board this idea. We were kind of a Johnny-come-lately among the developed nations of the earth as far as having a central bank is concerned. But we did get around to it. And what we did, and the way the Federal Reserve Act worked, was it divided the country into 12 districts. Each of the 12 districts would be overseen by a district bank. Now, to this day, it's kind of odd because at the time the Federal Reserve Act was passed, the West was still very sparsely populated. So the areas of the district banks out there were huge compared to the tight little areas of the district banks on the East Coast. And then, of course, now the West is very well populated, very active in the financial world. So you've got these Federal Reserve banks like in San Francisco that are dealing with enormous loads of work overseeing all the banks in their district. But anyway, here in where we are right now, we are very close to a borderline between two district banks. There's the district bank up north, Chicago, and then there's the district bank down south, St. Louis. Now, we happen to be in the Chicago district. Backdrop story, I have taken my finance students to the St. Louis Fed and to the Chicago Fed. It's like day and night. I see this all over the country. The feds that the district banks I visited, I mean, their character is, each one has its own thing. The St. Louis Fed just fell all over itself for us. It considers itself the education Fed. It produces all of these educational resources. It also does a lot of work with some of the big companies that are located in the St. Louis region. When we went in there, they had the chief economist speak to us, the head of their education arm talk to us. They were practically throwing opportunities for internships and jobs at the students. Come on, we would really love to see you. Professor here has said that you're all his best and brightest. I lied. But no, and what happened? I don't want that St. Louis. I want to be back in Chicago. Yeah, where you could be mugged on the Miracle Mile. No one wanted to, but you know, there you go. Go up to the Chicago Fed. They herded us into this little room and told us that we could go into this other room where they showed, you know, money shredded up and all that. But they packed us into this little tiny room to go through this narrow corridor. I'm at the back of the line. There's this big security guard. I mean, brick house. And she had a nightstick. And I had the students go in first, and I was at the back of them. And just as I was about to step through the gate, she cracks me with the nightstick. You stay out here. Oh, damn you, rhino. But after a while, we got to be friends. It turned out to be very charming on a date. But the thing is that the Chicago Fed just saw itself as something above this kind of nonsense with the little people and all that. The St. Louis Fed just, it didn't fling its doors open. If one of my students had gone down the wrong place, they would have shot him to death. But, you know, that's just the Fed these days. Boy, the security is unbelievable. And I finally asked, I have some of my former fellow students from Ohio State from many years ago work for the Fed. I said, is it true they have like these SWAT teams, Federal Reserve SWAT teams, that just live in the basement in case there's a terrorist attack? And he said, well, I can't tell you one way or the other, but I wouldn't recommend that you test it because you wouldn't live. And so, you know, I mean, there's serious playas in that because there is a fear of a bank robbery and they're not going to let that ever happen. The big vulnerability now, though, is the vulnerability of the cyber space. Anyway, now, the Federal Reserve establishes that there will be seven governors. They are the board of the Federal Reserve. One of those seven is the chairman. Don't let me fool you. Which statement is true? There are seven governors plus one chairman. No, that's not true. One of the governors is the chairman. The governors are appointed by the President of the United States with the advice and consent of the Senate. And the chairman in special hearings is appointed. Does anyone know who the current chairman is? Yellen, yeah. Yellen, okay. I saw something that was kind of weirded me. I didn't know, I'd never seen this before. There was a mention in a financial news article, well, the co-chairman said, and I thought, wait a minute, co-chairman? I'd never heard the term co-chairman of the Federal Reserve. There you go, though. Apparently, they've got kind of like a new position now that Yellen is not on her own. She's still sort of like the spokespoint for the Fed, but apparently there's a little bit more democratic decision-making going on. Now, the seven governors historically have been cream of the crop, the best of the best. Honestly, they're not anymore. Some of them are just almost jaw-dropping their lack of credentials. The district bank presidents, on the other hand, are cream of the crop. You meet one of these cats, and you know you're meeting someone who has years of experience in the industry, the consummate political perfection. I don't even think they have sex. But, they're just like perfect in every way. They never say things wrong. They're always, hail, hearty, and how are you? They're just excellent. And you know these people are not stupid. These are as bright as you can get those district bank presidents, literally. And they have ideological differences. Don't get me wrong. Some of them are much more interested in helping the economy. Some of them are much more interested in controlling inflation at all costs. I'll talk about that in a minute here. But here are the jobs of the Federal Reserve per the Federal Reserve Act. One, the Federal Reserve regulates and supervises the banking system. The governors regulate, the Board of Governors regulates, and the district bank presidents or district banks supervise. In other words, the governors set the rules and then the district banks enforce those rules in their district. Now, some of the districts, interestingly enough, have, historically, there was one district bank for a region. Some of the regions are so big that they have more than one district. They're all the same district bank, but they have different branches around the region. Regulates, Board of Governors. In other words, they make the rules. Supervise, that's the district banks. They enforce the rules on the banks in their district. The second is that the Federal Reserve serves as a bank for banks. Banks have to put their money somewhere. They have to deposit it. They have to have a bank. They can't put their money in their own bank. The Federal Reserve operates in direct competition with private commercial banks that also offer banking services for banks. The rules are like this. When the Fed must work on research and development to advance and enhance the technologies of banking. And every innovation it makes, it has to share them for free with its private competitors. It has to share it for free with them. That's why we have ATMs. That's why we have those magnetic little numbers on the old-fashioned checks and all that. It was all Federal Reserve research and development of the technologies that it then just shared openly with the other banks. The Federal Reserve cannot do predatory pricing. It must price competitively, but its competitive prices discipline the private commercial banks so that they can't overcharge fees to banks for the services as well. Someone asked me, it's been some years back, well, how many banks use the Fed for their bank, and how many banks use one of these private commercial banks for their banks? I didn't know. So I called the St. Louis Fed, and at the time, this was someone I knew. He said, about 65% of all banks use us in the St. Louis Fed region, and then 35% use private commercial banks for their banking services. And so I looked at financials of banks that do banking services, private banks. They were making great profit. They were doing fine. In other words, the presence of this 800-pound gorilla wasn't hurting them at all. They were making a lot of money. The Fed makes scads of money. It just turned over a check for billions of dollars for its profit for last year, just hands it over to the Treasury Department every year. Here, pay down the bills, pay some bills. That's what the Fed does. Now, if you think about it, and I wrote about this at the time when the whole Affordable Care Act was being debated, I wrote an article and I tried to contact a couple of representatives I knew. Why don't you do a system like the Federal Reserve does? Have a health insurance that's offered by the government through an agency, but it's in direct competition with private insurers that do the same. If there's research and development done by the public sector version, has to be shared, no predatory pricing. It works, and it's worked for decades for the Fed. No one was interested in that. It was either they just didn't want to hear about it. Most of them didn't even know that the Fed actually does this bank for banks thing. Now, there you go. Third one. This is the biggie. The Federal Reserve conducts monetary policy. Federal Reserve conducts monetary policy. Here's the interesting part of this. By the way, the very end of this lecture, I'm going to show you something absolutely fascinating. Something that, if you get it, it will really bother you. But let me go on. Conduct monetary policy. The original charge of the Federal Reserve was to maintain stability of the aggregate price level. That's a fancy way of saying you print money at the rate that will keep inflations or deflations from ever happening. That's your job. In other words, you print money, extra money. You grow the money supply at the real rate of growth of the economy so that there is a stable liquidity. If you overprint money, you create inflation. If you underprint money, you create a deflation. We don't want those. So Federal Reserve, your job is to print only enough money, grow the money supply, to provide the extra money, enough money for all the businesses and the consumers that need money. No more, no less. In other words, it was a depoliticization of the Federal Reserve. See, because, I mean, a politician would love to have the Federal Reserve print tons of money to make the economy feel better right before an election, and then deal with the inflation that's created afterwards. And the Federal Reserve Act specifically wanted to take that political temptation out of the hands of the politicians. It's a pity they hadn't done that for fiscal policy, in other words, tax policy as well, but at least the monetary policy, they got it done. Until the 1970s, when Congress passed and the president signed an added responsibility that the Federal Reserve was also charged with using the money supply to assist the economy. In other words, the hell with your original rule. We want you to print money. If the economy is going into a recession, print money. It'll make everyone feel better, and then you can claw it back in when the inflation hits, which is not as easy as you might think. We went through a spiral of inflation through the 70s. More money was printed to make the economy feel good. But that eventually caused inflation, which made interest rates go up with the inflation premiums. So we print more money so that the economy feels good again. Oh, that oil price shock? Let's print some more money to make everyone forget about it. And by the time we get to the end of the 1970s, we were in a very bad inflation. An inflation where no matter how much money the government printed, it just went into inflation and higher interest rates right away. So the president at the time, 1979, he threw himself on his sword and he appointed this wicked chairman of the Fed who just clamped the money supply and just held the throat of it. No one believed he was going to be any different from any other Fed chairman. Unfortunately, they were wrong. That Fed chairman, tall Paul Volcker, was just an absolute son of a bitch. He didn't care. He was actually a man. He smoked these big cigars. He's still around. He'd just blow cigar smoke in your face if he didn't like you. He crushed the money supply, and we got out of it in the 80s. But anyway, so there you are. Conducts monetary policy. The Fed has three tools for conducting monetary policy. The first one is blunt. Three tools of monetary policy. The first one is blunt. You would not see the Fed use it unless there were some really, really good reason. The first of the tools is the required reserve ratio, the RRR, or the fractional reserve ratio, some people call it, the FRR. Essentially, it's how much of a depositor's money the bank has to keep in the vault. So we start with this. You saw $1,000 sitting on the sidewalk. Now, are you just going to walk by it, sir? You are, huh? You lie. You're going to take that $1,000 and run with it. Okay. You come to me. I'm the bank. Okay? Now, I get that money in, I want to keep some of it in the vault. In case you come back for some of your money, or you write a check to this gentleman and he comes in and demands satisfaction on the money. So, let's say that the reserve is 20%. That means you have the rest that is lendable. You can loan it. So, we start with $1,000. That's the base amount. Well, I'll have to keep $200 in the bank. That means I have $800 to lend. You, sir, come into my bank and say, I should like to borrow some money. For what? Well, I was thinking of starting my own internet Lonely Hearts website. Okay, that sounds reasonable. How much you need? You say, I need $800. Well, I just happen to have $800. So I lend you the $800. You pay this internet genius here to set up the website and all of that kind of stuff and secretly collect their credit card information so that you can use it for nefarious purposes. And you have $800 now that you are paid. You come to my bank and you put it in. So notice now that my bank's balance sheet shows $1,800. Well, of that, I'm going to have to keep 20%, so that's $160. And the remainder, $640, I've got available to lend. And then you come in to my bank, my good finance student, and you say, I should like to borrow some money. For what? Well, I was thinking of starting my own, like, assassination service. Sweet. Okay. How much do you need? Well, I'm figuring, some basic equipment and some ninja outfits. $640. Well, I just happen to have $640. So I lend it to you, and you go out and get the services of this former special ops guy right here. And he comes to my bank. You pay him $640 to get all your thing all set up. And so he comes to my bank and he puts in $640. $2,440. Look at what's happening to the amount of money that my balance sheet is showing. It just keeps going up and up. So I have to keep a reserve of 20% of that, $128. So I have the remainder, $512, which will come back through. By the time this is over, that $1,000 of real, actual physical money has become $5,000 on the balance sheet of that bank. $5,000. How do I know that? It's easy. It's a very simple calculation. You take the original amount, money base, times the money multiplier. The money multiplier is just 1 over the required reserve ratio. In this case, 1 over 0.20, which is the multiplier, is 5 times. 5 times. The Fed sets the required reserve ratio. You see what would happen if the Fed had that set it at 10%? That original 1,000 would have become 10,000. 5%, that original $1,000 would have become $20,000. So you see why I call this a blunt tool? Because the Fed moves that thing around a little bit, and boom, you got a whole lot more money suddenly blossoming onto the balance sheets of banks. Again, this was a question that was put to me some years back. Well, maybe about 5 years ago. Well, what is the Federal Reserve's required reserve ratio? What's the actual number? You say 20%, 10%. What is it actual? I'm just sitting there kind of pig-faced. I don't really know. So I called the Fed. This time I didn't talk to someone I knew, but I'd gotten a good referral. And he said, believe it or not, your question really doesn't have an answer, a single answer. I said, and the what? And he said, there are actually 3 required reserve ratios. There is a required reserve ratio for the first, I think it was $10 million tranche, T-R-A-N-C-H-E, tranche of money in a bank. And then there is another required reserve ratio for the next tranche up to, I can't remember, I think it was like 50 million. And then there's a third required reserve ratio for money in the bank above $50 million. And I didn't know that. So I said, okay, what's the first tranche? What's the required reserve ratio for the first tranche? And he said, 0. I said, what? He said, yeah. I said, are you telling me that a small bank that has, let's say, $8 million doesn't have to keep any of them in the vault? He said, well, yeah, I'm sure they would. Well, wait, no, why? Yeah, that's the way it is. And I can't remember what the numbers were at the time. It was like for the next tranche, it was like 2.56%, 2.50%. Then above that, I think it was 4.0%. They were very low numbers, interestingly enough. And in other words, there was an aggressive using this to make the money supply grow quite aggressively. Normally, when the Fed would move this around, if the Fed is afraid that people are getting worried about the banking system, they would probably bump that required reserve ratio up across the board, just so there was the banks had enough money in their vaults for a run. And if the economy is doing well and people have great confidence in the banking system, well, then they would probably push the required reserve ratio down. And it's more about how worried the Fed is about people running banks than it is about changing the money, growing the money supply. But there you go. The second one is the discount rate. The Federal Reserve lends money to banks at what's called the discount window. It sets a discount rate for banks to borrow money. Banks don't have to go to the Fed. They can actually borrow money from other banks in what's called the federal funds market. They can just borrow from each other if they want to. Now, the discount rate is lower than the federal funds rate. But historically, banks didn't go to the discount window. They went to each other, even though the rate was higher in the federal funds market. Now, the question would be, why would banks go to other banks? Go.
A little
more than a stigma. Let me start it to you this way. Okay. I'm your dad. Okay? Don't go there, okay? Really? You know. And he is your rich buddy. We've both got money to lend you, and you need $1,000 ASAP. I mean, this is going to be whether your butt lives through the night, kind of. Okay, so I'm kind of a harsh father. You know, I'm the one.
You have failed me for the last time.
Okay. I'm not mean. I'm just rather curious about why you need this money. And who's that girl whose tattoo name you got on your arm. And why there's gunfire outside. I might ask those questions. You could go to him and say, I need $1,000 for a few weeks. And you say, sure, bro. Okay. So who are you going to borrow the money from? He's going to charge you an interest rate. I wouldn't charge you. Okay. Who are you going to go to? Oh, yeah, you're going to go to him. You're going to stay out of the house until you got this problem covered. Exactly. Historically, banks didn't go to the Fed. But after the crisis of September 15, 2008, the Fed just opened up the spigots. Free money. Interest rates you can't, 0.1%. All the money you want. And so the tide turned and the banks just lined up for money from the Fed, borrowing it there. And the Fed was obviously, this money's going to go to these banks. The banks are going to lend money to consumers. We're going to lend money to businesses. And the economy will come back from the debt. They didn't. The bank said, well, there's a credit crisis. We really can't lend to those people and those businesses. They started putting the money into their own investments, into stocks and bonds, overseas investments. For 3 years, they just kept hoarding the money and investing it where they wanted, not where the Fed wanted, not where the politicians wanted. They kept saying, credit crisis, we can't lend money. And of course, it just drove even some of the more conservative magazines like Business Week and Forbes were just losing it. Will you? They kept interviewing these bank presidents of these big, huge banks. When are you going to start lending? Don't you understand? You're getting free money from the taxpayers.
Well, we don't see it as prudent right now, and we're all about prudence, us big banks. Dude, you've been on the verge of collapse for the last 20 years. Don't talk to us about prudence. Anyway.
So notice this though. The discount rate is set by the Fed. That federal funds rate, FFR, is set by the free market supply and demand forces. The Fed can target what they want the federal funds rate to do, but they can't set it.
What they can do is put money into the system or pull money out of the system to try to move that Fed funds rate around, but they can't directly set it. It amazes me how many times I've heard on these financial TV shows, well, the Board of Governors set the federal funds rate today at, no, they didn't. They might have set a target for what they want it to be, but they can't make it that because that's a supply and demand of lendable funds thing in the federal funds pool of money, all that money that the banks have all aggregated together. So here we go to the open market operations. You might see the required reserve ratio changed every once in a great while. The discount rate is changed more like a signal. We raise the discount rate, they do, just to say, well, we're going to try to fight inflation. Or they lower it, saying, well, the economy's a little shaky. Or they leave it alone to say, well, the economy's where we want it to be. We're not going to do anything to it. But this would be changed at the 8 meetings a year, possibly. Maybe at a special meeting they could do something with it. But it's not really moved around all that much. The OMOs happen every day, day in, day out. The domestic desk at the Federal Reserve Bank in New York does this. Now, the last thing that I'm going to show you, and I'm going to show you a picture. I would hope that you had been shown this in your econ class. M1 is highly liquid money. It's money you can spend right away. It's cash and it's demand deposits at banks, checking accounts. It also includes traveler's checks, but hardly anyone uses those anymore. They're highly liquid. M2 includes M1, but it also includes stuff that is not as liquid, like NOW accounts, negotiable order of withdrawal accounts. They look like checking accounts. They're what credit unions do. Not as liquid, although most of the time they are. It also includes small time deposits, smaller CDs, less than a couple of million. M3 is the monster. It includes M2, which includes M1, but it also includes huge time deposits, the hundreds of millions of dollar CDs, and it also includes the euro dollar. The dollars that we pay to others to buy their stuff that they put in their banks. Now, let me show you something interesting about these monetary aggregates. I'll have to turn off a light so you can see this well. I published this on my site where I wrote my economics and political articles. My site was destroyed, and everything on it has been wrecked and ruined. But here it is. The Federal Reserve stopped publishing M3. It said, okay, no one uses it. That was a lie. In 2006, in the spring of 2006, they stopped publishing it because it was skyrocketing out of control. This isn't the level of M3. This is the growth rate of M3. M3 was spiraling out of control, and so the Fed stopped publishing it. Notice what the Fed had been doing to try to control the overgrowth of M3. It had cut the growth rate of the base money supply, M1, the money that you and I and businesses use. It had cut that growth rate to zero. In other words, the economy was growing, but there was not liquidity being added for the growth. That's why we buckled in 2008 in September. It just wasn't growing. Now, this chart, the Federal Reserve has altered this chart. I published this in mid 2008. I was writing, there's going to be a crisis. And I showed all this. People more or less, yeah, you're a conspiracy theorist. Go ahead.
What chart?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll show you. You should have said something before then. Okay, so I'm going to show you what's happening here. Now, this goes back to 2000. I was warning. Well, it's warming up. I'll give you a quick background again. I was warning that there's a crisis. And in 2008, the crisis was simply that. Early in the morning, massive amounts of money were being pulled out of the money markets. The money markets were in a full-blown catastrophe. The Fed, at 10 o'clock, stopped all withdrawals from money markets. If the Fed had not done that, 2 hours later, the banks on the East Coast of the United States would have all buckled. But now you can see how M3 was just spiraling out of control? That was because we were buying so much more than we were selling overseas, and all those euro dollars were accumulating in foreign reserves. So what did the Fed do? It cut the growth rate of M1, the money that people and businesses use, down to zero. People say, oh, this is an interesting chart. It's actually more interesting than you think. First of all, the Federal Reserve has altered this data. They've now put in a gray band saying that there was a recession in 2000, which was why the government had to enact the longest, deepest tax cuts in American history. That was a lie. There was no recession. And a lot of people say, well, what's that big weird spike up and then down? I say, oh, that's just 9/11. When the planes hit the buildings, the Fed was afraid people were going to run the banks, and so they had this massive operation where they drove trucks all over the country with real cash so that the banks could take care of any run that happened on the banks. All well and good, right? Federal Reserve came through. As it turned out, people didn't freak out, and then the Fed drained the money out. Once it was clear, people weren't going to freak out and run to their banks. But wait a minute. Wait a minute. See that spike, that point right there? That is 9/11. Why was the Fed pouring money into the banks the month, the week, the days before 9/11? That was not a one-day truck run. It had been going on. Not for a day or two. It had been going on for weeks. They had been moving high degrees of liquidity into the banks, trucking cash. Were they just like wanting to have banks have cash? Or did they know something bad was going to happen? It's your call. I also heard there was a lone gunman. That's all I have for you tonight. Thank you.